so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with James K. Boyce. He's an author, economist, senior fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His most recent books, both published in 2019, are The Case for Carbon Dividends and Economics for People and the Planet. Jim earned his BA at Yale, PhD at Oxford University, and he's written in most major organs, Harper's, Scientific American, New York Times, LA Times, many academic journals, Ecological Economics, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. He's also contributed working papers to INET. He's contributed videos to INET, participated in conferences, and really been at the vanguard between social sustainability and the issues of climate. Jim, in 2017, received the Leontief Prize for Advancing the Frontiers of Economic Thought, and he continues to do that to this day. Jim, thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
You and I are talking here in August of 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic has, walked on the set. Many things are being now challenged. Many things that were thought to be efficient and safe and on the frontier of productivity and well-being are now in question. How does this pertain to your concerns, and how has the pandemic shock affected the way you're seeing the world and what you would like to do about it?
Well, I guess when it comes to climate change and climate policy, policies to deal with climate change, which is really one of my main interests, I see the pandemic as having an upside as well as a downside. The downside, of course, is what we're all too familiar with in terms of the suffering, not only in human health, but in people's economic well-being, that has come with the pandemic and with the bungled response here in the United States of the national government to dealing with that pandemic. And that, of course, has pushed other issues, including climate change, somewhat to the side. At the same time, however, I think the pandemic has possibly helped to set the stage for a real burst in terms of innovative policies and public support for those policies to deal with climate change and with the climate crisis, partly because I think it's shaken up people's sense of complacency insofar as they were complacent before. The idea that things can change radically and for the worse rather quickly is something that, of course, climate activists have been saying for a long time, and the pandemic kind of has thrown that into stark relief. Also because with the pandemic, two things have come up that are relevant for climate policy. One of them is the importance for people of having regular income sources that aren't solely from their own work, because labor income from work is, it turns out, vulnerable to economic downturns like the enormous one we've seen in recent months. And so the policies adopted here in the United States to provide income support to people, including the $600 extra pandemic unemployment compensation, reflect the fact that having secure sources of income apart from what we earn in the workplace can help to give people a source of economic security. And as we can talk about, it's possible to construct climate policies that actually will help to provide that kind of income. The second thing that's come up, and this is especially important, I think, in the countries of the world like India and China, where the air pollution problems have been enormous and very visible, both in terms of the dirtiness of the air and in terms of the political awareness of the people. To a large extent, those air pollution problems are another of the bad side effects of relying on fossil fuels as our main energy source. When we burn fossil fuels, we not only emit carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, but we also emit a slew of other really nasty pollutants that are hazardous to people's health. And with the economic downturn from the pandemic, people suddenly could see blue sky, in some cases for the first time in a long time. And it was a very vivid demonstration that the dirty air that so many people around the world have been forced to become accustomed to as just sort of a normal part of their lives is in fact not normal. It's an aberration that comes from our fossil-fueled economy, and it's something that we can cure by moving forward in the clean energy transition. So it's my hope, Rob. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a total Pollyanna-ish optimist on this score, but it's my hope that with the kind of shakeup in the kaleidoscope of consciousness that has come with the pandemic, and with these insights about the importance of basic income support and the value of clean air, we may actually have set the stage for really getting serious about tackling climate change.
Well, Jim, you've written about a carbon price and argued for the need for a carbon price. And you've also talked about how, we might say, how that relates to social sustainability. So there are other dimensions to it. But first, let's talk about why do we need to put a price on carbon?
Well, the way I'd put it, Rob, is that what we really need to do is put a limit on the amount of fossil carbon that we allow into our economies and, of course, from the economies into the atmosphere. We need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. That's the starting point. And to do that, the most straightforward and reliable way to do it is simply to say we're going to reduce the amount of fossil carbon that we allow into the economy of the United States, of Britain, of India, of China, wherever. We're going to reduce it by a certain amount per year on a trajectory that's consistent with meeting the Paris goal of stabilizing global temperatures at a level no more than 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial levels. Now, a carbon price is actually a side effect, an artifact, if you will, of taking steps to limit the amount of fossil fuels we allow into the economy. It's not a price for the sake of a price. It's a price as a result of limiting the amount of fossil fuels that we're using. Think of what happens when OPEC wants to raise the price of oil. What it does is it cuts supply. Well, it's basically the same dynamic, the difference being that when OPEC does it, the extra money that you and I and all consumers pay for fossil fuels goes to the oil companies and to the oil cartel. When we instead limit the supply by public policy, when we do it via a cap with auction permits or a carbon tax or a combination of the two, There are other things we can do with the money, including the option I favor, which is returning the money, or at least most of the money, back to the people. The easiest way to do this, I should add, is by imposing the limit on the fossil fuels coming into the economy where the fossil fuels first enter, what they call an upstream system. So that means at the tanker terminals, at the pipeline terminals, at the coal mine heads, as oil, coal, and natural gas are brought into the economy, the firms that are bringing it in have to surrender permits that cost money, that are valuable for each ton of carbon that's embodied in each barrel of oil or ton of coal or cubic meter of natural gas. And those permits could be sold at a fixed price. In that case, what we're talking about is a carbon tax. Or they could be auctioned off with the quantity of permits fixed and the price going up or down depending on demand for those permits. Or perhaps ideally via a combination of the two, in which the tax serves as a floor price for carbon permits. And if demand at that price exceeds the supply, there's an auction and the price can go up as needed to meet the supply constraint. We already do something like that here in the northeastern United States, where I live, in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Every 3 months, there are carbon permit auctions for power plants, and the power companies bid for the permits, and the price can go up or down depending on demand, as well as the gradually diminishing supply set by the ceiling on carbon that they're allowed to burn. So that's the rationale for having a carbon price. It's not so much that we love prices per se. What we really love or need to love is protecting the planet by keeping fossil fuels in the ground. And what we need to recognize is if we commit ourselves to doing that by imposing a strict limit on the amount we're going to allow into our economy, it's very likely, almost inevitable, that the price of fossil fuels is going to go up. And so what we need then is to figure out a way to do that while simultaneously advancing the goal of protecting people's economic well-being.
So we've seen in the case of France that when we raised the carbon price, there was a great deal of protest in what people refer to as the Yellow Vest movement. What have we learned from that episode? And I guess what I would say is, how do we achieve a high carbon price for environmental protection and mitigate the social disruption that brought the Yellow Vests to the surface?
Well, that's an excellent question. The tax increases that were announced by France's President Macron back in November 2018 amounted to about 12 U.S. cents on a gallon of gasoline and 35 cents on a gallon of diesel. And Macron proposed to use that money to combat climate change, much like some advocates of carbon pricing call for using the money to fund public investments in the clean energy transition here in the United States. Those price increases that Macron announced were pretty modest compared to those that are likely to result from a really serious commitment to keeping fossil fuels in the ground. For example, cutting the amount of fossil fuels we burn by 8% a year over around a 30-year trajectory. Prices are likely to go up a lot more than 12 cents on a gallon of gasoline. And nevertheless, Macron's fuel tax increases provoked widespread outrage among working people in France. The protesters complained that Macron talks about the end of the world while we're talking about the end of the month. And it's not only French workers who worry about the end of the month. Many working families here in the U.S. and around the world worry too. And for good reason. They're struggling to pay the rent. They're struggling to pay their medical bills. They're struggling to feed their kids. So I believe that the only way we can secure broad and durable public support for an effective carbon price, for a price that succeeds in keeping fossil fuels in the ground on anything close to the Paris goals, is to return much or all of the carbon revenue to the people as carbon dividends. The way that would work is pretty straightforward. You collect the money, as I described earlier, through a carbon tax or auction permits or a combination of the two, and then you return the money to every woman, man, and child in the country implementing the policy on an equal per person basis. Now, when you do that, because in general, wealthier people consume more of everything, including more fossil carbon, they end up paying more in absolute dollar terms as a result of the carbon price, as a result of those increased fuel prices. They put more dollars into the pot, if you will. Not as a percentage of their incomes, which are very high as well, but more in absolute dollar terms. Middle class and low income households would pay less in absolute dollar terms by virtue of their smaller carbon footprints. They just can't afford to consume as much. But everyone receives the same carbon dividend regardless of their own consumption of fossil fuels. That means everyone has an incentive to conserve, to invest in energy efficiency, alternative energy, and so on. So the upshot is that the rich would pay more than they get back in dividends. Low-income families would get back more than they pay as a result of fuel price increases, and middle-class families would more or less break even. In explaining this, what I sometimes use is an analogy to a parking lot. I'm told that there are some big tech firms out in California where you've got a premium on parking space. Real estate there is expensive, of course. And you've got office buildings where the people need to get to work. And if they drive to work, they need a place to park their cars. And there isn't enough space for everybody to drive to work in a single occupancy vehicle and be able to park near the building. So what some firms have done is they've introduced what they call a fee-bate program for allocating scarce parking spaces. Everybody who parks in the parking lot has to pay into the pot based on how often they park there, just like any other parking lot. And at the end of the day, the money that's collected, at the end of the month, the money that's collected in parking fees is distributed amongst everybody who works in the building on an equal per-person basis. So say there are 1,000 people working in the building, and there are only 500 parking places. You set the parking fee to limit demand for those parking places so you don't overrun the lot. And then you reallocate the money to everyone, regardless of whether they park there or not. So the result is that somebody who doesn't drive to work, who takes public transportation or takes a bicycle, gets back this, you know, more than they've paid in. They haven't paid in anything into the pot, but they get their share of the revenue. The people who drive to work every day in a single occupancy vehicle pay more than they get back. And the people who carpool or drive some days and not others more or less break even. That's the same basic idea as the carbon dividend idea that I just outlined. The only difference is with carbon dividends, what people are paying for is to park carbon in our atmosphere. But the basic idea is the same. And to pay out those dividends is not rocket science, Rob. Already in the state of Alaska, there's a program called the Alaska Permanent Fund, which was instituted by a Republican governor back in the 1980s when Alaska began to pump oil. And it takes a chunk of oil royalties and distributes them to every person in Alaska, every man, woman, and child on an equal per person basis as dividends. And if listeners want to find out about the Alaska Permanent Fund, if you know it, if you live in Alaska, you already know about this. But if not, and you want to learn about it, just go to their website. And among other things, you can see the form where people sign up to receive their dividend checks. They have to produce evidence that they are a bona fide resident of Alaska, but if they are, they then receive their proverbial check in the mail, or more often these days, it's an electronic transfer into a bank account. And in Alaska, the amount of the dividends has been as high as about $2,000 per person, for every woman, man, and child, per year. So it's not difficult to collect the revenue where the fossil fuels enter the country, nor is it difficult to return the money to the people as equal per capita dividends. And that's what a carbon dividend policy would do.
So a number of climate justice advocates are reluctant to accept the notion of carbon pricing either being effective or... Are there concerns related to this, what you might call the carbon price without the dividend, exacerbating inequality, or are there concerns from some other dimension?
Well, I think you're right. There are certainly concerns, and these concerns are well-founded. Or at least some climate justice and environmental justice activists have been skeptical of carbon pricing for understandable and good reasons. Some of them are concerned that carbon pricing doesn't work. They look at past experiences like the EU emissions trading scheme, for example, and they say, look, you know, this hasn't achieved emissions reductions on anything near the level we need to stabilize the Earth's climate. And they're absolutely right. The reason for that is that the prices have been set too low and have not been accompanied by a commitment to a firm trajectory for emissions reductions that's consistent with the Paris goals. So the solution to that problem is not to give up on carbon prices altogether, but to anchor the carbon prices to an emissions trajectory that's going to make sure that we keep the fossil fuels in the ground. Doing so is very likely to result in higher, possibly much higher carbon prices than those we've seen in most places in the past. Some climate justice advocates put more emphasis on regulations and public investments as a way to deal with the problem. But public investments and regulations don't rule out having a carbon price. They're not mutually exclusive. And as I said at the outset, what I think is crucial if we're going to be sure of meeting our climate goals is to limit the amount of fossil carbon we burn. So putting on that limit and facing the consequences in terms of rising prices is something that I think we need to do alongside with other measures as part of a broader package that includes smart regulations, smart public investments, just transition assistance for people and communities who are adversely impacted by the move away from fossil fuels, and so on. Another objection to carbon pricing, and again, it's very well founded, and this goes back to our earlier conversation about the Yellow Vest movement in France, is that carbon pricing is regressive. Even though the rich pay more than the poor as a result of carbon pricing because they have bigger carbon footprints, nevertheless, as a percentage of their incomes, the poor pay more than the rich because fuels are a necessity, not a luxury. And so carbon pricing is a regressive tax. There's no way around that. It is regressive in that it hits the poor harder as a percentage of their incomes than the rich. So climate justice, economic justice, environmental justice folks are absolutely right to worry about a carbon price in that it would regressively hit lower income households harder than anyone else. But that's why we need carbon dividends. If we have carbon dividends, as I was saying, the effect is to make the net effect of the policy of the higher fuel prices coupled with the recycling of the money as dividends to make it progressive. So the result is to actually not only protect the incomes of low-income households and the middle class, but in many cases to increase their incomes because the dividends more than compensate for the increase in fuel prices. Finally, one other point to mention about concerns from the climate justice, and particularly the environmental justice community here in the United States, is that some people worry, and again, I think this is a completely correct thing to worry about, that if all you do is have a carbon price, if all you do is clamp down on the amount of fossil fuel and raise the prices, you're going to get emissions reductions, but you won't get those reductions everywhere. And you won't necessarily get them in pollution hotspots, in the places where you've got the most pollution, dirty air resulting from the burning of fossil fuels, near power plants, refineries, and so on. And very often, the majority of the population living near those facilities are low-income people and people of color. And so what they worry about is that, well, you might achieve your climate goals, but you're not going to address the disproportionate pollution burdens that these people face. And who knows, you might even exacerbate their burdens. And there's evidence actually from California, which implemented a cap and trade policy, another kind of carbon pricing policy, about 8 years ago, that this is exactly what has happened. That not only have you failed to get even reductions in emissions across the state, but in certain locations, emissions have gone up. And those locations tend to be places where there are disproportionate numbers of people of color and low-income people living nearby. How does that happen? Well, it's actually not hard to understand when you think a little bit about what the electric power supply looks like in California. What's happened with the cap on emissions in California is you've seen a movement away from coal towards natural gas. Natural gas produces carbon dioxide as well. It's also a fossil fuel, but per unit electricity, per kilowatt, it doesn't produce as much as coal. So when you have a cap on carbon emissions and a price on carbon emissions, what you do is you create an incentive for power producers, for generators to move away from coal towards natural gas, which has already been happening anyway as a result of sheer market forces with the shale gas revolution. And so what you've seen is an increased amount of electric power generation from gas plants and a decrease from coal-fired plants. Now, coal-fired plants and gas plants are located typically in different places. And as a general rule, the coal-fired plants tend to be located further away from population centers, often in very sparsely populated locations. In some cases in California, it's even imported from out of state, from the Four Corners region, for example. And natural gas plants tend to be smaller, and they tend to be located closer to major population centers. And as I've said, they tend to be located in environmental justice communities, communities of color, and low-income communities. And so as you ramp up the production of electricity from those gas-fired plants, or even build new gas-fired plants, you're going to ramp up the pollution in those communities from all the nasty stuff that's emitted along with carbon dioxide. So you get this paradoxical result that you're addressing the problem of climate change by reducing carbon emissions, but you're not only failing to assist those communities that need it the most in terms of cleaner air, but you're actually making their air dirtier. This is what's called the hotspot problem in environmental economics. And the way to deal with that problem is to bake into the design of the climate policy constraints that make sure that you achieve at least as much reduction in emissions in EJ communities, environmental justice communities, as you do overall. And better yet, that ensure that you get bigger reductions in those communities because they're the places where the benefits to society in terms of clean air and public health are the biggest. So that's another reason why what we need in climate policy is not a silver bullet. There's not a one-size-fits-all remedy, and if you just do this one thing, everything's going to be hunky-dory. No, what we need is a smart mix of policies, and those policies should include a hard limit on the amount of fossil fuels we allow into our economy, which is the safeguard for making sure we achieve our targets, and which is, again, very likely to bump up prices. We need to have smart regulations like fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. We need to have smart public investments in things like mass transportation and a smart grid. And we need regulations that ensure that the hotspot problem is addressed rather than be exacerbated in the course of the clean energy transition.
So is this, I've seen in some of your articles, you're talking about the co-benefits of climate policy. Is this what you're referring to, or is that still another dimension?
The air quality and public health co-benefits are precisely what I'm referring to here, Rob. So again, when we burn fossil fuels, we're not only emitting carbon dioxide, we're also emitting sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, a slew of other hazardous air pollutants. And these things impact people's public health in very dramatic ways. Outdoor air pollution is considered by the World Health Organization to be one of the top 10 causes of premature mortality worldwide. We're talking about millions of premature deaths a year, particularly in places with exceptionally bad air quality like India and China. And a lot of that air pollution comes from burning fossil fuels. So it's important to bring that into the conversation, I would say, for two reasons. One is that once we recognize these clean air benefits of reducing our use of fossil fuels, and in the climate policy literature, these are called co-benefits because they come along with the benefit of trying to stabilize the Earth's climate. Once we recognize those clean air benefits, we have a rationale for more aggressive action to reduce emissions, and we have a benefit from reducing those emissions that accrues to the people living nearby in the political jurisdictions that are cutting their emissions and accrue very quickly, immediately, in fact, as we saw during the COVID pandemic when people stopped burning as much fossil fuels. The sky turned blue, right? Public health benefits can come very quickly. So that near-term proximity in time and the spatial proximity of having the benefits accrue in the places where the fossil fuels are being burned means that lifting up these benefits and bringing those into the conversation helps us to break through two of the biggest impediments to dealing with climate change, which are that it's long-term, not short-term. It's going to be sometime in the future, but it's not hitting us today, or at least some people, you know, it's starting to hit us today, but a lot of people still don't think it's such a big deal yet. And secondly, that the benefits of cutting carbon emissions are global. They accrue all over the world, whereas the benefits in terms of public health from reducing the emissions of co-pollutants are local. So it helps to create the public the political will to overcome the international free rider problem with why should I cut my emissions if someone else doesn't, and the myopic thinking, what in economics is called a high discount rate, where you don't worry about so much about the future because it's too far away. You're worried about the present day. Well, the air quality benefits are present day benefits, and they, again, accrue in the place that adopts the policy, even if other countries don't. In fact, there's a lot of research that suggests that you could have a pretty good case for reducing your use of fossil fuels and putting a price on emissions simply based on the public health benefits to your own population here and now, in which case the benefits in terms of addressing climate change, those would be the co-benefits. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason why these air quality co-benefits are so important is that once we tune into them, we can see that it actually matters where you cut your emissions. It's not the case that a ton of carbon is the same as a ton of carbon wherever it's emitted around the world, because in some places, that ton of carbon is emitted with more co-pollutants that damage the health of more people, and particularly of vulnerable populations that are already suffering from a variety of deprivations and discriminations in the economic system. And so it means that we need to think about, in our design of a policy for moving ahead in the clean energy transition, how to maximize these air quality co-benefits and ensure that they're distributed equitably and, above all, distributed or shared by the communities that need them most. So both from the standpoint of helping us to get over the hurdle and institute effective climate policies, and from the standpoint of fine-tuning those policies in a way that ensures that everyone shares in the clean air benefits that come with them, it's really important to bring this piece into the conversation. And that's why, really, I would say, along with my work on carbon dividends, this has been the other main thing I've worked on in the arena of climate policy, is how to integrate co-benefits into policy design.
Well, when I look at, first of all, let me flag back. The first paper I remember you writing for INET was about how the inequality in air quality by congressional district or zip code, I can't remember how the geography was defined, is actually even greater than the inequality of income in the United States. And I found that result quite startling, in the sense that I thought, put it simply, if the wealthy people on the Upper East Side have the means, not just money, but the political sophistication, whatever, to get a change in policy, they'll carry the rest of the people in New York City along with them by cleaning up and removing the toxic power plants. But somehow, in the larger scheme of things, the results, your research illuminated a very profound source of inequality in the United States.
That's absolutely right, Rob. And this is, of course, something that environmental justice researchers and environmental justice activists have been pointing out for years. And now there's an overwhelming body of evidence to demonstrate that the impacts of pollution are not distributed evenly, or anything close to evenly, across the population. It's not like rain. You know, Bob Marley once sang, "When the rain fall, it don't fall on one man's house." Excuse my poor singing voice, but you'll get the theme here, right? Well, it turns out when pollution falls, it does fall on some people's houses a lot more than on other people's houses. It's true that at the end of the day, we're all in the same boat. We all live on the same planet. If we really wreck the planet, everybody's going to be harmed by that. But it turns out that when it comes to a lot of environmental harms, we're in different boats. It's one of the big problems in our society. And so what you find is that systematically, there are much higher exposures of people of color, blacks, Latinos, Native Americans tend to have much higher exposure to various forms of air pollution, including air pollution from burning fossil fuels, than do white people. And there's also an effect of income. Within any of these racial and ethnic groups, having higher income means you're less exposed than having lower income. But the evidence suggests that there's an independent effect of race and ethnicity that's not only on top of the income effect, it's actually often more powerful. Race and ethnicity are incredibly important markers of vulnerability to environmental harm in the United States. And so the end upshot of this is that, yes, when we compare differences in air quality in different communities to differences in income across the population, even though we have to my mind, outrageous levels of income inequality in the United States. The inequalities in environmental conditions are even more outrageous. It's a scandal, and it's something that the people who bear the biggest environmental burdens are all too conscious of. But people who don't bear those burdens and don't, I have to say, often don't even set foot in those communities, go through life blissfully unaware of the reality that their compatriots are facing. And I think it's really important for us to learn about that and do something about it. It's a big part of the environmental picture.
Well, I started hearing Bob Marley's song, Exodus, Movement for the People,
yeah,
Movement of the People, as you were singing.
Well, that's what, that's what it's going to take is a movement of the people to get us out of this mess. It's not going to be that some politicians wake up and say, oh, let's do this. This is a great idea. The kinds of changes I'm talking about in terms of keeping fossil fuels in the ground, in terms of protecting people from the impact of higher fuel prices with carbon dividends, and in terms of ensuring environmental justice in the distribution of air quality co-benefits, all of those things will only come about if people get up and demand them. They're not just going to happen. So your invoking of Exodus is right on.
Well, I've been hearing it as I've been listening to various music inspired by the death of the murder of George Floyd.
Yeah.
In particular, the song that Teddy Pendergrass sang with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, Wake Up Everybody. No more sleeping in bed. He said, and the chorus is something to the effect of, we can't just let it be. We've got to change this world, you and me. There's got to be collective action, and Bob Marley's redemption song about freeing yourself from mental slavery also is playing a role right now, because people are throwing off the shackles of conventional wisdom, and which you might call playing a little deeper from the heart and moving into this space. Well, I have another couple of thoughts here I wanted to explore with you. First, people on the realm of the Green New Deal are talking about essentially something like government spending to change the structure of the provision of energy, the supply side.
And
it might be a job boost in this recovery from the pandemic and so forth. But are they keen on not the carbon price, but the carbon dividend? Is that the source of revenue that might help finance this this Green New Deal? How do these things fit together, or don't they?
Great question. Well, you know, as you know, the Green New Deal's basic aims are to curb climate change and to do so in a way that brings broad-based economic benefits to the majority of people, and especially to low-income people. And a policy of limiting the amount of fossil carbon that we allow into the economy and recycling the money that consumers pay as a result of the higher fuel prices back to the people as carbon dividends fits, I think, perfectly well with both those aims, both the aims of curbing climate change and bringing broad-based benefits to the majority of the people. Now, some GND or Green New Deal proponents understand this, but others are just unfamiliar with the idea of carbon dividends, and some are skeptical about carbon pricing in general, and some would prefer to use the revenue, if there is a carbon price, to fund public investments in things like mass transportation and renewable clean energy. We've already talked about some of the reasons why some people are skeptical about carbon pricing. Often in the past, the prices have been too low, carbon pricing is regressive, etc. Let me mention another objection that one sometimes hears, which is there's some folks who say, oh, carbon pricing, isn't that a commodification of nature? Why, they ask, should people be allowed to pay to pollute? But I think the real question is, why should people be allowed to pollute without paying? This doesn't mean turning nature into a commodity any more than installing parking meters along a city street turns the street into a commodity. Parking meters are just a way of charging for the use of scarce space, parking space that belongs to the public, and preventing the congestion that would result if all those spaces were free. In the same way, a carbon price, as I've said, would charge for parking carbon in the atmosphere. Others advocate the use of carbon revenue for public investment, and I want to say a few words about that. I'm all for public investments, as I've mentioned, as another crucial element of a smart climate policy. But I'm not in favor of funding those investments via a regressive tax that hits the poor harder as a percentage of their income than the rich. And as I've said, that's what a carbon price is. It's a regressive tax unless the carbon revenue or a substantial share of it is recycled to the public as equal per person dividends. I think there are better ways to fund public investment in the clean energy transition. Now, it would be possible to earmark some fraction of the total carbon revenues for public investment. That some proposals for carbon dividends have advocated, for example, putting 75% into carbon dividends and 25% of the money into public investment. And I think that's an interesting idea to think about. One reason is that when you look at where carbon is burned, it turns out that although the main ultimate users of carbon are consumers, because consumption is the bulk of our economy, and that includes not only our direct use of fossil fuels, but indirectly in their use in the production of the food and other things we consume. There's also a fraction, in the U.S. it's about a quarter, of total carbon emissions that come from the activities of governments, federal, state, and local governments. Everything from your local public schools burning fossil fuels for air conditioning or heat to the Pentagon burning fossil fuels for its military activities. And so about 25% of the money, if we did put a price on carbon, would actually come from the government, not out of people's pockets directly. It would come out of the government's pocket. And so I think there's a reasonable case that can be made for keeping the government whole in the face of rising fuel prices resulting from putting a limit on our use of fossil fuels. And so earmarking about a quarter of the carbon revenue for public investments in the clean energy transition seems to me to be a reasonable idea that ought to be part of the discussion. Lastly, let me just re-underline something I've already said, Rob. I don't think there's a silver bullet. Public investment is really important. Smart regulations, really important. Just transition policies for workers and communities hit by the transition away from fossil fuels is really important. But putting a hard limit on the amount of fossil carbon we allow into our economy is absolutely crucial to accompany these things. There's not a trade-off between these different policies. They all go together. And it's the hard limit that guarantees, it's the only thing that can guarantee that we'll actually achieve emissions reductions on a scale and at a pace consistent with the Paris goals. And if we have those hard limits, again, it's very likely that the result of that's going to be higher fuel prices. That's going to be like a regressive tax unless or until we recycle that money or a big share of that money back to the public as dividends. So, That's my take on it. I think there's no reason at all to think that the Green New Deal is or should be an alternative to having a carbon dividend policy. I think they can go hand in hand, and I think they should.
Yeah. I'm always reminded of my former teacher and often colleague, Joe Stiglitz. He says very simply, you got to tax the bads and fund the goods.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. I've got a phone ringing here. That just stopped. No, it hasn't stopped yet. This is a do-over then, right. Rob. I'll let you once this damn phone stops ringing, I'll let you do okay. the I heard yours ring earlier, so I don't feel that bad.
Yep. Yeah.
Maybe your tech guys can clean that out, but a do-over will work. Why don't you go ahead and hit the Joe Stiglitz question again? Maybe we should wrap up with that.
Yeah. Oh, well, I do remember my former teacher and friend Joe Stiglitz saying to me that he said this quite often over the years. He said, you know, what we got to do is we got to tax the bads to fund the goods. And that just feels like a little bit how these two policies, the Green New Deal and the carbon tax plus dividend, complement with an E each other.
I think that's right. Let me just make one caveat, though, Rob. The way you phrased it was tax the bads to fund the goods. And I think I would rephrase it very slightly and say tax the bads and fund the goods. And the reason I would say and is that sometimes taxing the bads can be regressive in distributional terms. It can hit the poor harder than the rich. And if you're relying on regressive taxation in order to fund the goods, chances are you're not going to be able to fund enough of those goods because the poor don't have enough money and because you're going to get a public outcry of the type we saw in France. So I think we need a combination of both. We need to tax the bads, that is to say, to tax pollution, including carbon pollution, and we need to fund good things like the clean energy transition. But the best way to fund the clean energy transition is not with regressive taxation, including taxing carbon. The best way to fund it is through other sources, including progressive taxation.
Yeah. Well, this takes me to my last question, which is related to the international environment. The carbon strategies and the transformation of the energy system in large countries like China, India, matter to the quality of the environment we have all around the world, as does the United States and Europe and others. But in the pandemic world, we're seeing a lot of tension between the United States and China. And you see a country like India, which has an extraordinary level of poverty. And it's almost unfathomable to think that they are going to tolerate that poverty, that suffering, that, how do I say, unaddressed propagation of disease in order to clean up the climate to save the advanced world, which is burning more carbon per capita than they are. And many people I've talked to on this podcast and otherwise from India are saying, to go back to your last comment, they're kind of two bads. One bad is poverty, and the other bad is climate deterioration. And they need global cooperation and resource transfers so the public good of cleaning up their environment is something they can do without essentially destroying a large part of humanity within their country.
Well, thanks for bringing up this other dimension of the climate justice landscape. It's really the global or international dimension. And it's one that's near and dear to my heart. I lived in South Asia and India and Bangladesh for 5 years. It's where my career got a start. Most recently, I lived in Delhi about 5 years ago. And got very interested and concerned with the appalling air pollution in that city now. And I think you're absolutely right that it would be unconscionable, really, for the rich countries of the world to try to solve the climate problem on the backs of the poor countries. And I think you're right that international assistance in helping low-income countries make the clean energy transition is another very important part of the overall climate policy mix. That said, I would also have to challenge to some extent the assumption, because it is an assumption, that there's an inexorable trade-off between reducing poverty on the one hand and cleaning up the environment on the other hand. In fact, as I've worked on a lot over the years, I think there are many ways in which we can pursue those two goals simultaneously. And in fact, there are ways in which it's being done. And that can be done in climate policy as well. So when we think about the benefits of the clean energy transition in a country like India or a country like China, first and foremost, what we can see are the local air quality benefits that would come from moving their economies away from fossil fuels, and especially from coal-burning power plants that ring major cities like Delhi in India. Those improvements will above all improve the lives of the poorest people in India, because it's the poorest people who tend to be exposed most to air pollution there as here. They're the people who spend more time outdoors, more time on the arterial highways, who can't afford air conditioners, who can't afford to live in the cleanest neighborhoods, and so on. So there are public health benefits that will be, that I think should be viewed not only as part of the benefits of climate policy, but also part of the strategy for reducing poverty, is to improve people's air quality. Secondly, if a country like India or China were to implement a limit on its use of fossil carbon of the type I've described, whether that limit would be as ambitious as or as steep as the limits that I think we should impose here in the United States and in other advanced economies, is an open question. But were they to limit the amount of carbon, they too would see an increase in the fuel prices. Again, that would be a burden on low-income households. But if the money were recycled back to their own publics through carbon dividends, you'd actually be making an important step in improving the economic well-being of the poor and in reducing inequality. In fact, the very first piece I ever wrote about this, Rob, which was published in a journal called Energy Policy back in 2007, was called A Chinese Sky Trust. And it looked at this issue in the context of China. My co-authors and I looked at what would happen if China were to have a carbon price, a carbon tax, and recycle that money to the public on an equal per person basis. Who would pay? And how? What would be the net distributional impact? And the results were, there as here, that you would have a progressive effect on the distribution of income. You would increase the incomes of the poor because they don't consume much fossil carbon at all in China. And you would be reducing the net incomes of the rich, because they would be, they're the ones who consume the most fossil fuels and would be paying the most. And for them, the dividend would only cover a fraction of their increased cost. But the rich can afford it. In China, they can afford it. In India, they can afford it. In the United States, they can afford it. And so in every country of the world, a carbon dividend policy of the sort I've advocated would be a positive thing, not only for addressing the climate crisis, not only for improving air quality, but also for improving the economic well-being of the poorest people and reducing inequality. And this is potentially one way in which we can get around the impasse that's held up climate interaction, held up climate action on the international stage for so long. In those negotiations, the annual UN-sponsored negotiations on climate change, so much of the conversation is about who should do more, who should do less in order to cut their emissions. Well, as I've said, a carbon dividend policy with the clean air benefits and the economic benefits for the majority of people makes sense for any given country, regardless of what other countries do. It doesn't matter in the United States, whether China's cutting its emissions or not, in terms of the desirability of a carbon dividend policy. It's still a good policy because we get cleaner air and we get carbon dividends that make some dent, a modest dent, in the extreme income inequality, which is another of our national ills. Similarly, in China or in India, it doesn't matter what other countries are doing to cut their emissions. If they too adopt a carbon dividend policy, they're going to get clean air benefits and they're going to get economic benefits for the majority of their people. So I think one of the attractions of the approach I've been talking about, an approach that starts with each country saying, we're going to cut our use of fossil fuels along a defined trajectory, and we're going to deal with the resulting impact on prices in a progressive way by recycling the money back to the people as dividends. That can really help us to move forward even at a time when international negotiations are at something of an impasse.
Well, Jim, this has been a tremendous exploration and tour. I'm inspired as I listen to you, how you shine a light on so many different things. And I hear in my mind a song of that name, Shine a Light by the Rolling Stones. And it says, may the good Lord shine a light on you, make every song you sing your favorite tune. And you get your Jamaican bonus points today, but yeah. you and I are from Michigan.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take you to the fourth verse of my favorite song by Marvin Gaye called What's Going On. And he says, wow. Oh, you know, we've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today.
Absolutely. And you, that's one of my favorite songs too, Rob. We share that same background. And I just want to thank you. Thank you for doing this podcast. Thank you for trying to get this message out. You know, one of the problems with carbon dividends is I tell people, they say, how come I've never heard of this idea before? And I say, well, it's because nobody's going to get rich from carbon dividends, right?
That's
and
right.
Therefore, nobody's putting up a lot of money to inform you about this as a policy option. If you want it to happen, it's got to happen by word of mouth. It's got to happen by grassroots pressure. That's the only way forward. And so in a small way, all I can do is hope that this podcast and all the other ways in which climate activists are working on these issues around the world manage to move the needle and move us forward and help us address this problem, which is such an important one for the future of humankind.
Well, you bring, you shine one last light on this question. And when you raise, why don't people know this? In essence, because so much in the realm of ideas is used as marketing rather than as illumination.
Exactly.
And you are providing what I will call a global public good. When Marvin asks the question, we've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. You are what I point to. You are an example for the young scholars. And that's just my fellow Michigander. I've always loved your work, and I'm very grateful that you could join me today. And I will bring you back after the election, and we'll talk about, in light of those results, what we need from American governance. I think in quite a hurry.
Well,
to get on
that,
track, but
that,
the challenge
that would be great, Rob. I certainly look forward to that, and I tell you, man, I can't think of a higher honor than to be mentioned in the same breath as Marvin Gaye. So thank you for that.
Yeah, he's pretty good stuff. Thank you. You tell us what's going on. We'll talk to you soon. Again,
okay, bye-bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.